Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
I have not been giving my refrigerator enough credit. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. I pretty much take for granted the fact that I can go a week or more between trips to the supermarket, feed my family leftovers without fear of foodborne illness, and access all the ice I want instantly, even on a 90-degree day in October. I'm willing to bet that you take your fridge for granted, too. Just about every American household has one, and we like our refrigerators big. So big, in fact, that some observers wonder if bigger cold storage capacity has played a role in America's obesity problems. Jonathan Reese is professor of history at Colorado State University Pueblo and author of the new book Refrigerator, which is part of the Object Lesson series of books published by Bloomsbury. John, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
I love books that cause me to notice something that has been right in front of me all along, but mostly escaped my notice. Pretty much everybody in an industrialized society has a fridge, even if they never cook.
That's true. Fridges have spread from America first and are all around the world now.
And American refrigerators, on average, are the largest in the world. How direct is the line between a large fridge and a large percentage of overweight citizens?
It's an interesting question. I don't think that question has been completely settled yet, but the logical connection is simply you have more food laying around your house, whether it's perishable or not, you might end up being more obese if you go to that refrigerator more often.
How did people deal with perishable foods before refrigeration?
Well, they had ice boxes, for one thing. In the United States, an ice box is literally a box with just some ice in it. And you would close the door and the ice would melt, but it would keep your perishable food fresher than if you had no ice box at all. That's probably the most common way. There are, of course, lots of other ways of food preservation. There's drying, there's salting, there's pickling, things we still use now, but we do it because those things taste great instead of because we have to, because we have no other choice.
My husband and I were talking about this the other day. He pickled some carrots, and they're delicious, but like as a condiment, I can't imagine eating pickled carrots, you know, every night for 2 months in the winter.
Yeah, root vegetables, that's when seasons really matter. One of the great effects of refrigeration is to make us oblivious to the seasons when certain things are fresh. Like fall apples, we still remember, but you know, strawberries have seasons. Eggs used to have seasons.
That's such a strange thing to think about, but they were a spring food.
Yes. Yes, they were. And then cold storage comes along at the beginning of the 20th century, and it becomes something that you can eat all around. And at first, people were suspicious of it. They thought it was a way to for the providers to charge higher prices. But then when you could get eggs all year around, they got used to it, and they started taking it for granted, just like refrigerators.
Our definition of what fresh means has changed. It once meant literally just picked or maybe just slaughtered in the case of meat. Today, we judge something to be fresh, and it could be weeks from the farm. It just means not rotten and still edible.
Yeah, or you know, frozen closer to the point at which it was picked. This is something that's really uniquely American. Places all around the world still want to go out and get their stuff every single day because they care more. I mean, it sounds weird, but they care more about taste. I know a lot of people, and I'm one of them, who went to Europe for the first time, started trying the vegetables and the fruits and just went, wow, this is beyond all my previous experience. It's something that most people just take for granted, that food is supposed to taste a certain way. And when they do taste food that's fresher with less refrigeration or preservation, it just changes what they think good food is.
Europeans, of course, have supermarkets now, but there's still many people are still in the habit of going to the market every day or two.
Indeed. And much smaller fridges, sometimes no fridges at all. I've seen and I don't have them right at my disposal, but I've seen the refrigeration percentages from just about every industrialized country in the world. And, you know, the United States and Canada, it's about 99.5% of households have refrigerators. And it's still a substantial percentage lower in places like Italy or France. And they're still over 50% now. But really, America has been the refrigeration leader for 150 years, and other countries have been catching up. I don't think they'll ever really want to completely catch up with us. I don't think we'll all have giant refrigerators all around the planet because of cultural differences. But we've sort of been dragging them along for a while now.
It's strange to think that everybody once had a relationship to the Iceman, or everybody who could afford it anyway.
Yeah. Indeed. So the Iceman, actually it's urban areas mostly, but there are Icemen in rural areas in Texas 100, 125 years ago, would come and deliver the ice, drop it in your ice box, and that would be how you would keep your perishable food fresh for the week. Well, really every other day usually, but that for whenever you're chopping. Between visits.
Icebox is a term that a lot of people remember their grandparents calling the refrigerator. Was that something in your house?
Indeed. It was my parents who called it that, and I still use it occasionally, but I know the difference. One of the interesting things that I learned with working on my first refrigeration book, which is a book called Refrigeration Nation, it came out 2 years ago, was that before there were electric household refrigerators, they used to call ice boxes refrigerators.
Hmm.
So an ice box was a refrigerator when there's no alternative. But then when you have an electric household refrigerator, they had to come up with a new term for the old refrigerator to differentiate it from the new one. And that's when they start using the term ice box.
So producing heat, John, is a pretty straightforward thing. Humans have controlled fire for a very long time. Why is it so much harder to artificially cool things?
Because it's a technical process. You have to figure out a way to draw heat away from a particular space. And that took hundreds of years and a lot of different inventors confronting the problem and then building on what had come before. And even once you have a refrigerator, well, I should put that a little differently. Even once you have refrigeration, being able to shrink that into a box that'll fit in your kitchen took another 50 or 60 years in order to get that right. It's a technical process, and for heat, you just light a fire. Figuring out exactly how to draw heat away is just much more complicated.
So what's happening exactly in electric-powered refrigeration? You have a wonderful, simple explanation in the book, a couple of small diagrams, but I'm guessing that you can do this in layman's terms for us here.
I have to admit, if there are any refrigerating engineers out there, please don't send me angry mail. Because I needed a lot of help from people who understood this better in order to be able to explain it. Essentially, and this is the very, very simple explanation, there's a substance called a refrigerant. You boil it under pressure, and when, this is where I always mess up, when you boil it at the first part, when it draws in heat, when it turns from a liquid to a gas, I think that's right, and then on the back side of the refrigerator, it goes back from a gas to a liquid and gives off heat. Your refrigerator is both hot and cold because of this. And it'll change state because it's under pressure. That's the compression cycle of refrigeration. It's been that way since about 1860 is when engineers figured that one out. And they've been perfecting it to make it a better kind, to make the refrigeration better ever since.
Electric companies loved this invention because it takes a whole lot more juice to power a refrigerator than a house full of light bulbs.
Indeed. 24/7. So they are selling refrigerators in the 20s to people at a discount just so that they will buy the juice. Funny, one of the things when I was doing the Object Lessons book dealing with the present that I didn't know when I did my first book, which was just a history of refrigeration, is that the refrigerator has been passed as the most... as the appliance in your house that consumes the most electricity. It is now your cable box that consumes the most electricity in your house. Yeah, it kind of floored me too. But a refrigerator is still a lot.
And of course, they've become more energy efficient over time, but the design, the basic design hasn't really changed that much?
Well, the basic machinery of a refrigerator hasn't changed since the 1860s. That's that compression cycle I was talking about. So they start as these giant 5-ton machines. Around 1920, they become household machines for the first time. You still have those giant 5-ton machines in different places, but they manage to compress it into something that'll fit in your kitchen. And then they've been making that more efficient since 1920 and adding amenities. I write about that quite a bit in the Object Lessons book.
A lot of those giant refrigeration systems use ammonia. Why wasn't that practical for use in the kitchen?
Oh, because it's noxious. If it leaks, it'll smell up the whole house. And it's potentially explosive.
Hmm. So Freon was a big deal.
That's 1930 is when Freon debuts. And it is safe to breathe, and it is much more efficient than the other refrigerants. And that's why they used it. It took them a while to figure out its effect on the environment. And they've been changing the CFCs since around 1990. But it's still the same basic chemistry, even though the kinds of CFCs we use now are different than the ones that were invented back in the 30s.
Jonathan Rees is my guest. He's professor of history at Colorado State University Pueblo and author of the new book, Refrigerator. It's part of the Object Lessons series of books published by Bloomsbury. We'll come back to our conversation with John in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call 800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. Back in 2 minutes with Jonathan Rees.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Colorado State University Pueblo Professor of History Jonathan Rees. His new book, Refrigerator, is part of the Object Lessons series of books. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. John, I think this book would be interesting not only to people who care about the history of refrigerators, but people who care about the history of marketing and advertising. How did refrigerator manufacturers market their products in an era when it was assumed that men would earn the money and women would rule the kitchen?
It's interesting. The refrigerator ads that you can just find anywhere online are some of the most beautiful pictures you'll ever see. There's one of a avocado green refrigerator from the early 60s that I have in the book, because it's in black and white, so it doesn't do it justice, but you can imagine what an avocado looks like. And I'm just fascinated by that one. I kept it and I stare at it periodically because it's so interesting to me. I don't even know why. they market them at women. It's one of the few places in the house where it's assumed that a woman will have some control over the purchase in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. But they also have to appeal to men. Men are the people who are assuming the refrigerator manufacturers are assuming are going to be writing the checks. So it's this sort of parallel track, and it makes refrigerators a really interesting proxy for gender relations in mid-20th century America.
And, of course, they suggested that a refrigerator was a great place to keep a cold beer.
Indeed. Indeed. That was one of the ads in the book from the 50s. Why would a man care about the refrigerator? You can get a beer from it. That's about it. The cooking is done by the women. This is necessary for cooking. So most of the refrigerator ads are directed at women. One of the things I noticed talking to kitchen designers is that's changed in recent years. Our fascination with steel-colored refrigerators comes from the fact that they're more accessible to men than a white one or some of the old colors that they used to have, like avocado green.
Avocado green, there was that like harvest gold. There were all kinds of delightful fridge colors.
So, yeah, it starts in the early 60s, goes into the 70s. So I have memories of one of those avocado green ones. I think that's why I like the ad so much.
Let's go to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Sherry on the line in Keller. Hey, Sherry.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
I just wanted to make a comment that I just bought my first refrigerator. It's a 10 or 11 cubic foot, and I just love it. So if anyone's been eyeing those small refrigerators, I highly recommend them. very efficient, and I was glad to hear that comment about the size of your refrigerator might be linked to possibly your waistline. And then the second comment I wanted to make was I was looking at very old antique refrigeration advertisements, and a big major thing that happened back in the day was you might have food in the refrigerator that you thought was fresh, and you serve it, and there's a portion of it where there's food poisoning, and that would make people violently ill. And so that's a problem with early refrigeration that you don't hear too much about anymore. That was very prevalent in the advertising. Apparently it was a very big deal, and if anyone's ever gotten food poisoning, they know how awful it can be. So I just wanted to make that comment and say thank you for to the guest for this interesting topic.
Thanks for your call, Sherry. I know, John, that it was common for different zones of the refrigerator to be very different temperatures before they separated out the freezer compartments.
For sure. You're welcome. And yes, that's absolutely true. It's still true today. The refrigerator door is the warmest part of the refrigerator because you open it all the time. And for that reason, that's why the butter tray is there, just to give you one example. What else was I going to say? The earliest refrigerators aren't very good at refrigeration. They're not perfect. The refrigerant would leak sometimes, or they would need service calls, very expensive service calls, until about 1927. So that's probably where the food poisoning mentioned in those ads come from. Also, food poisoning is a way to get people to buy refrigerators, because in the 20s and 30s, the Iceman is still there. The Iceman survives until the late 50s. And that's how refrigerators competed against the Iceman. Ice could still give you food poisoning. It's inefficient refrigeration. It won't always keep everything cold. Therefore, you should buy a refrigerator that works 24/7. And by 27, the first mass-produced refrigerators were really pretty effective. And that becomes a way to get people to buy their first one. And then we were talking about size. Increasing the size of the refrigerator is a way to get people to buy their second one. The average refrigerator longevity period today is between 13 and 17 years. I've seen numbers all along that spectrum. And that's not good for refrigerator manufacturers. They'd like you to buy a refrigerator, you know, much, much more quickly than that. So they would come out with more expensive refrigerators, which are usually bigger refrigerators. And that's how you would get a new refrigerator, even if you don't need one, because they'll convince you through their advertising that you'd have to have everything for a party ready to go if people suddenly show up at your house.
My favorite ad reproduced in the book shows a nice lady meeting up with her friends, I guess for like a leisurely game of bridge or something, but she cannot focus on her cards because she's so worried that her refrigerator needs her attention at home.
Yes, that's defrosting. It's probably the most important technological change in refrigerators in the 20th century. They start with frost-free, which limits the number of times that you have to defrost it, unplug it overnight to get rid of the ice. And then 1960 is when you get frost-proof for the first time. Right now, the only time you have to unplug a refrigerator to defrost it is those very small ones. What happens is, I was talking about a refrigerator being both hot and cold, and that's part of it. The hot is used to defrost the back of your refrigerator, the places where frost might accumulate. And you don't have to do it anymore because the machine will do it for you.
I hadn't realized until I read your book that early on you could make ice in a refrigerator, but there wasn't a separate freezer compartment. You just had to know where to put the ice tray.
Which is close to the machinery. The closer you are to the machinery, the colder it gets. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm one of the few people who's looked at the history of refrigerators very closely, despite the fact that they're so important. So it's been very hard to figure out exactly when all of these changes are made. But it's true. The very earliest refrigerators, you just put the tray very close to the machinery where it's coldest. And then about the 40s is when you start to see the late 40s is about where you start to see separate freezer compartments. I don't have a good technical explanation for that. That's one of those things that I hope future historians of this topic explore.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Demetra in Allen. Hi, Demetra.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
What an interesting subject. I think food history is as important as art history. It shows how the civilization developed. Thank you for bringing it up on the radio. I wanted to comment that I grew up in Greece the first 20 years of my life, and even though we lived in the city, every summer for 3 months, we would live with my grandparents in a town with no power. And as children, it never occurred to us that, oh, we have no electricity, we have no refrigeration. My parents to this day, they only use the refrigerator to chill wine, to get ice, and maybe preserve some milk. And your guest put the question forth earlier, how did people live before refrigeration? And that's why I called. I thought, oh, I know exactly how they did. I've lived like that. In my grandparents' house, there was a cellar where you kept the onions and the potatoes and all the things that would stay. You preserved meat either in salt or in pork in its own fat. You did not eat unseasonable things. You only ate what's in season. And something interesting, I wonder is how many people know this. Greeks are Greek Orthodox, and they, around the calendar year, they follow a fast, they fast before Christmas, they fast before Easter, they fast before a celebration in the summer. And those fasts, I wonder if the people who designed this religious fasting, the fast is designed around what's in season every time. Everybody knows that Greeks eat lamb for Easter. Well, that's because lamb is the available meat. All the baby lambs are born in February and March, they're ready for Easter.
Huh.
My other comment has to do with supermarkets in Greece. And when I say Greece, I think I can cover southern Italy and southern France. I've lived there for a while. They only started selling produce in the last 10 or 15 years. And to this day, people do not really buy them much there. I myself, who have lived out here for 20 years, when I go there and I need to buy some salad greens or a fruit, if I buy it at a supermarket, I feel guilty. I feel like, you know, how you buy milk from 7-Eleven when you need it. It's just not done.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Demetra. What a fascinating perspective on all this. Is there anything Demetra brought up, John, that you want to talk about?
Yeah. First of all, I do cover a lot of the before time in Refrigeration Nation, which begins before there were refrigerators. I actually start with the American ice industry in that book, which goes back to 1806. So I know that everything that Demetra said about Europe is America before there are refrigerators. I think the thing that I want to stress there is the importance of women's labor to making all that preservation possible, all that marketing, all that cooking, all that bottling, canning, whatever, however that food is being preserved. It just takes an enormous amount of time. A lot of people, when they get their first refrigerator, are just amazed about all the extra time they have. And so in a nation where so many women work, the United States, it makes perfect sense that we would be beholden to our refrigerators because we simply wouldn't be able to get it done. Men, women, whatever, we wouldn't be able to prepare food and do all the work that we want to do and still have leisure time if we were living in a pre-refrigeration culture.
Jonathan Rees is my guest. He's professor of history at Colorado State University Pueblo and author of the new book Refrigerator, also of an older book called Refrigeration Nation that came out a couple of years ago. We'll resume our conversation with him in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Jonathan Rees, who's professor of history at Colorado State University Pueblo and author of the new book Refrigerator and the 2013 book Refrigeration Nation. You can join us at 800-933-5372. That's where we find Linda in Fort Worth. Hello, Linda.
Hello. I wanted to share with you that I actually personally experienced the transition between the Iceman and a very primitive refrigerator. My grandmother had an icebox, and this guy would arrive and have this heavy, heavy leather apron across his back and huge, scary ice tongs, and would yank up a big chunk of ice and carry it back to the back door and drop it in her icebox. And my parents got a house, and they bought a refrigerator. And it stood up on legs and had a huge coil on the top, and that was where the power was generated, was from this big coil.
Linda, I'm so glad you called and brought that up. There's an illustration of this in the book, John.
That sounds like the monitor top. The first mass-produced refrigerator was 1927 to 1937. Yeah, that sounds exactly like it.
And those sold pretty well, but then somebody realized that if you could put space on the top where people could, like, put the loaf of bread or all the things people like to put on top of their fridge, let their cat hang out up there, that would sell even better.
Yeah, they managed to integrate it, and then suddenly the top of your refrigerator was free for the rest of the life of refrigerators.
800-933-5372 is our number. We have Deepak on the line in Farmers Branch. Hey, Deepak.
Hi. I had a quick comment, please. I was thinking with technology, you know, progressing at such a dizzying pace, I think the same should apply to refrigerators as well, because I was envisioning, who knows, maybe it's already invented, but this is what I was envisioning, that I'm walking down the grocery shop aisle, and my iPhone notifies me that I'm missing, you know, eggs or anything that is in my refrigerator, because it got the notification from my fridge. So in other words, the fridge is a smart fridge that can, that knows exactly what it has, because everything you put in it, you have to scan the scan the barcode, so it always knows what the contents are, and it keeps an inventory. So that was just a suggestion, and I also want to find out, does such a thing exist, or and when would it, you know, become commonplace?
Thanks so much for your call, Deepak. In our house, that's done by corresponding spouses, but what do you know about the technology, John?
I do. That's been around for about 15 years, called an internet fridge, part of the Internet of Things. I'm honestly not a big fan of it. I think that the purpose of a refrigerator, if I have an argument in the book, it's this. The purpose of a refrigerator is to keep things cold and fresh. Anything else is just gravy and generally unnecessary. The internet fridges are available now. You can get them on Amazon.com, and they're very, very expensive. A much more interesting technological change to refrigerators, which I'm not really qualified to explain, is a new way to make cold involving, I believe it's water and magnets. And the result of this is going to be is to make the refrigerator just require much less power and be better for the environment. And I think that's wonderful. And I think that you'll see that in the next 10 years. Your refrigerator will operate differently. I guess you have to know how your refrigerator operated before in order to notice the change. But it will make running a refrigerator much more environmentally friendly. And I think that'll be wonderful. And you'll still be able to keep your stuff cold in it, which is the main purpose of a fridge.
So there's this question as to whether, because our fridges are big, we buy more than we need, and some of it goes to waste because it gets lost behind, like, you know, the mayonnaise jar or whatever.
Yeah.
But you think that the fact that fridges can keep a lot of food fresh and edible makes them worth their environmental cost?
Yeah, it's because they cut waste. I mean, things will be wasted in a refrigerator, but they cut waste all the way through the food chain, from the point of production of whatever perishable food you're talking about, through transportation and storage and in your home.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. You know, we might buy half a pound of cheese and it might last a month. I don't think it would last a month sitting on the counter, just a few days.
Yeah, that's the big warehouse problem. You get more than you need. You at least have a fighting chance of getting through it if you have a refrigerator that'll fit.
All right,
fit whatever you just bought. Yeah.
Let's go back to the phone. We have Mary on the line in Dallas. Hey, Mary.
Hey. I am wondering about the freezer, the refrigerator-sized freezer. that I remember in the late 50s and early 60s, they had a campaign where they were going door-to-door selling freezers. My parents bought one, and with that, they got like a half a beef for free, and it was a big push to, you know, everyone to have their own huge freezer. Was that just evolution or offshoot of the refrigerator, or...?
It's evolutionary. Freezers, the separate freezers come along in the 40s when the refrigerators aren't big enough to keep everybody's food fresh. The 60s is about where frozen food becomes popular, and that's what's going to be in everybody's freezer. So buying meat is this sort of temporary interregnum between having your first efficient freezers and suddenly filling them all with frozen food rather than the thing you just killed while you were hunting. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of a 40s and 50s thing. The reason your story makes me laugh is it makes me think of the I Love Lucy episode where they bought a side of beef and got trapped in the freezer. I think I referenced that in the earlier book. It's very, very iconic of the mid-1950s.
Yeah, my grandparents had one in the 70s, probably left over from the 50s, and it was referred to as the deep freeze. It lived in the basement, and that thing was so coated in frost that there was about, you know, 2 cubic feet of storage in it because the walls had closed in over time.
The other great American refrigerator story is to take the old fridge and put it down in the basement and fill it full of drinks. Right. Because your new fridge is great, but your old fridge works perfectly fine. And you don't really feel like throwing out your old fridge because it works perfectly fine. But you'll be equipped with soda and beer forever thanks to your new old fridge in a different spot.
It's the American way.
Yeah.
All right. I think we have time for one more call here. We have Lynn on the line in Irving. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
I'm calling because I'm seeing a trend with my daughter's generation. She's 25, college educated, and she is very much kind of calls herself a foodie. But what I'm seeing is that she is canning more. She's doing lots of what I would call what my grandmother and my great aunts used to do, who are born in the turn of the century. Lots of canning, lots of food preservation, lots of fresh food purchasing due to season. She goes to the farmer's market. And I'm wondering what you think about a generational turn back to the way things used to be, like we heard about our European callers.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's a backlash against our sort of refrigeration-obsessed culture to have a few things that really are fresh, at least fresh when you can it or preserve it. I think it's a great thing. I don't think we need a 32-cubic-foot refrigerator. I wouldn't get rid of refrigerators if I ran the world. I would just have us all buy 22-cubic-foot refrigerators and spend a little time figuring out where our food comes from. So, yay. Yay, new generation. That's my reaction.
John, you've now spent years of your career, and I'm sure you work on other things as well, but learning about the history of refrigeration, how did this topic become such a focus for you?
I went to graduate school in Wisconsin, and Wisconsin used to be the center of the natural ice industry in the Midwest. Hmm. And so I got interested in it because ice was a dead industry. And it's just nice to study history where there's not a lot of other people who are doing it. So I started with ice, and then I ended up going into refrigeration because that's the natural extension of the ice industry. And really, the 2013 book, Refrigeration Nation, is the first scholarly analysis of this in 50 years. So it was just wide open space. So more I got into it, the more interesting it became.
Are there certain items that are always in your refrigerator?
In mine, you know, that's interesting. My refrigerator is not used as well as it should be. It's actually broken right now, shockingly enough. And I can't fix it. I have a call in to the refrigerator repair guy. So the top is kind of warm. It's not as cold as it should be. And the freezer's going great guns. I actually have frost, which is how I knew it was broken. Because you're not supposed to have frost on one of these things. So I am not a huge refrigerator. I mean, I obviously need my refrigerator. But I'm not good at systematically thinking about my refrigerator. Because I'm trying actually to be more like the younger generation and cooking more and preserving more outside the fridge.
Jonathan Reese is professor of history at Colorado State University Pueblo and author of the new book Refrigerator, part of the Object Lesson series of books. He's also author of the 2013 book Refrigeration Nation. John, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for making this time for us.
Oh, you're very welcome. I enjoyed it a lot.